Hi, and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Carl Dixon from Coney Hatch, who's also been with April Wine and the Guess Who. But many of you will know him from Coney Hatch, who are actually back together and about to release a new album, aren't you, as well, Carl? Is that correct?
That's right. We are putting out in the space of the next couple of weeks a live show we did in Germany.
Wow.
At the Heat Festival there, one of the most crackling live shows we've ever done. And two brand new studio tracks attached to the front end of the record as well.
Oh, fantastic. I absolutely can't wait to get hold of that. Is that coming out on vinyl and CD?
Vinyl is a little bit later in the game, but yeah, it will be on vinyl. CD will, you know, CDs are always quicker to make. There's a big backlog at the vinyl.
They are. They are. So Coney Hatch, a band that I absolutely loved from every album, but your journey to Coney Hatch. I mean, one of the bands that actually you also play with later in your life was the Guess Who, and they were one of the bands that actually inspired you to be a musician. Is that correct?
Yes. Growing up in Canada, when I was a boy, they started to have the Guess Who started to have their hit records in the States, and they became, once American Woman became a number one, it was like Canada was on the map for rock music suddenly. And they were really like our Beatles in Canada. It was, we were so thrilled that, oh my goodness, look what those guys from Winnipeg are doing. That we were always, I remember being 11 and 12 years old and so excited to hear the next single from the Guess Who coming on the radio. And we'd run down to the record stores to buy the new albums as soon as they came out. And the first record I ever bought was a 45 of the Guess Who, the songs Undone and Laughing. And then years later, the first, when I was 14, maybe the first big show at a rock show I ever saw was the Guess Who at the Canadian National Exhibition grandstand. I saved up all my money from my summer job and went down for a summer splash in Toronto just before school started again. And so that really touched me in terms of, listen to that sound. Look at the band on the stage. How can anybody be that good? And certainly the listening to those records, as well as all the other influences I had, but listening to Burton Cummings singing, he was just a primo rock singer of all kinds, really had an influence on me and how I shaped my style.
Interesting. So through the 70s, as you went into your teens, your background, I mean, like in a band like the Guess Who, because a lot of your contemporaries, as we entered into like the, you know, melodic rock and AOR stuff and heavy metal of the 80s, they probably weren't listening to the Guess Who. They were listening to the more obvious kind of bands.
I suppose you mean my contemporaries in the the world or in Canada?
Yeah, like all the other bands that were kind of coming out at the same time, they were probably listening to, Zeppelin, Purple, those kind of bands, weren't they? Or, Van Halen was 1978 and et cetera. But, the Guess Who was quite a traditional rock band. Well, as you say, your version of the Beatles almost.
Yes, they churned out the singles every year. They had a sense of pop music for the radio. Yeah. Their producer structured their arrangements that way. Chorus within the first 30 seconds, two verses, get to the solo, little bridge, vamp out, do some improvs, and 3 minutes and 10 seconds, you're out, that you had to do that to get on the radio. And the radio was the biggest pusher of record sales in those days. So yes, they structured it very much along the Beatles model. And I guess many ideas in how music has been created were established by the Beatles model. But I was precocious as well in my listening. I was into Johnny Winter and The Who and Humble Pie and Mountain and Free.
Brilliant.
All the sort of bluesy, heavier rock bands as they were at that time, they just had a certain feeling of weight to them, I guess. This is important, serious music. They just, by the way they structured it and the performances vocally and on the instruments, it just made me feel strong, made me feel, yes, I want to convey that feeling.
That's interesting, because I wondered that, because there's a very much like earthy, soulful aspect to your voice that's very, that kind of, on all the albums, but it seems to have progressed as you've gone through life. It's kind of enhanced itself. But I always wondered whether you were influenced by kind of people like Paul Rodgers because of that kind of feel that you have, how you kind of, the tonality of how you put the lyrics together. So that's really interesting.
You know, it's interesting. The old Hit Parader magazine that used to come out of New York City, I guess it was, when Coney Hatch was first starting, and they had an interview with Lou Gramm at that point, where they asked him to list his top 10 influencing albums. And it was the same with mine, basically. You know, he mentioned Free, and then he mentioned Bad Company and Spooky Tooth. That was a big one. The later versions with Mike Harrison and Barry Wright both singing. And I probably have the biggest Spooky Tooth collection of anyone. I've often joked that I should start a Spooky Tooth tribute band, but there's probably not much market for that.
No, but they're a great band though. So it's great. It's great to hear them mentioned. Now, Coney Hatch themselves, that you signed in the UK, their first album came out on Phonogram Records, which is a big label, 1982, produced by, is it Kim Mitchell from Max Webster? And it contains, I remember this, I'll just tell you this because it's probably good for you to know. Hey Operator was played in the pub jukeboxes, not pub juke, but the rock DJs and everything. And I knew that song a bit. And I think it was on a sampler as well somewhere. But it was when I bought the album, and I was the first one out of my friends to buy it. And Devil's Deck, the opening track, just put that on a tape, and I just lent it to so many people, and so many people went and bought it, and the guitar solo in there and your vocals. It's a timeless rock track, isn't it? You must still do it to this day.
Yeah, we really hit something with that track. And, you know, Coney Hatch, we've established my, what would be called top 40 AM radio leanings, as it was in North America at that time, as well as my bluesy rock side, but that's where I was coming from, and the idea of song structure and a great vocal performance. And Andy Curran was really coming. He loved punk and new wave, and the more simpler vocal delivery. And that, I guess I was probably the second most schooled musician in the band. Andy and Dave, our drummer, Ketchum, they came up with that just pick up an instrument and go, you know, learn on the job. So and Andy was also the guy that liked Australian rock before anybody else that we knew. So they had already established the band for about a year with Steve Shelsky, Andy and Dave. And then I joined through an ad in the Toronto Classifieds, and I went to see them, and the singer I was going to replace decided that music was too hard. He was going to go back to school, but he'd given them a few months notice. So I came and saw them, and I thought, well, okay, they play. I didn't even like AC/DC when I first heard them. And then I really grew to appreciate and about what was great in it. But they were playing a lot of AC/DC because the singer I replaced was crazy for the stuff.
Yeah.
So then they played probably a dozen original songs on a bar gig. And I thought, okay, these guys have some balls, you know, they're pushing it. They want to get somewhere. Cause I already knew, I was 21, I guess then. Already knew you can't go anywhere unless you have your own song, and they're great. You know, it doesn't matter how well you pull off Girls Got Rhythm, you know, get up to the next level until you create your own material and your own sound. So that impressed the hell out of me that they already had 12 songs. Now, I remember thinking those are the strangest songs I've ever heard, because our lead guitarist, Steve Shelsky, came out of a jazz course training at Humber College here. Wow. So he was looking to lay in those odd sounding jazz inversions. And then our drummer, Dave Ketchum, he just whacked the hell out of the drums, but he was also The press release used to say he saw Keith Moon at the tender age of 7 and was never the same. So it was really four quite different musical elements combining, each bringing a different sensibility to the party. So with Devil's Deck, for instance, I'd been in the band 2 weeks, and we were in the era that time of playing a week in one town in a bar somewhere, play every night. Then after we go on to the next town on Sunday.
Yeah.
So the only way you could develop material was you get up in the morning before the bar opened, because all your stuff is already set up and it's a waiting rehearsal room while
the
are vacuuming the floor and they're cleaning up the bottles from the night before the bar opens. So we'd have to get up, get down there 9, 10 o'clock and go through our new song ideas. So Andy had actually written the words for Devil's Deck, and he had a rough idea of what he wanted the verse to be. And I'd just been in the band 2 weeks. And so Steve said to him, look, we've got Carl. He's a great singer. Let's give this one to him to sing. You know, we got to start giving him something to do to put the sound of the band forward. Because I was singing most of the nights on the cover stuff.
Yeah.
And to my chagrin, my later enjoyment, I had to learn about 10 AC/DC songs right out of the gate. But we were playing crazy things in the cover repertoire at that time. The Cradle Will Rock, Van Halen.
Yeah,
The Moon by the Police. And Andy used to sing Drugs in My Pocket by the Nuns, and or the Monks, rather. Monks.
Yeah.
Yes. And Crew Slut by Frank Zappa. It was the craziest.
Wow. Set list. What a set list. Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, because we had to fill 3 hours a night, right? And plus the dozen or so crazy original songs. So I had had this idea. I was always fiddling around with guitar ideas. And I had these two different things that I thought, well, that could be an intro for one song and that could be an intro for another song. Great. You know, I'm set next time we're starting a song out. And then the key song, Devil's Deck, happens to be an E, and both the licks were an E. So I said to Steve, okay, I'll teach you this part. You play this part. I'll play the other part. We'll combine them. And I bet it'll sound really cool. And that's where that intro came from. I'll let you in on a little secret. It's a slight inversion of a Free song off the Highway album. The Stealer.
The Stealer. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because that has that bout.
Yeah. It does. Yeah. It does.
So I changed. I was such a Free freak. I probably didn't even know I was aping it at first. What it made it different was I shifted the rhythm of the riff an eighth note earlier. And then I combined it with this melodic overlay on the other guitar. So that's the origin of Devil's Deck. And then Steve came in with that really proficient solo. He could just peel off amazing things without even thinking about it on guitar.
Oh, it's so melodic and so lyrical, that solo. It just fits so well. I mean, your knowledge of music, obviously the way you were talking there, you're very knowledgeable. Your early years, you were taught piano, weren't you? And you went to conservatoire. So you have a deeper understanding of kind of music theory in that respect.
Correct. Yes. I started on piano, and for many years afterward, I'm not so much that way now, but when I picked up a guitar, or I imagined a guitar part or a melodic interval, I always imagined it on the piano keys, my mind, when I didn't have an instrument close by to try it out on. And that stuck with me for a long time. You know, the early training we get in anything sticks with us.
Of course.
Correct. So from there, I wanted to play guitar, because I was falling in love with all this rock music coming on the radio, and I hated it. I hated the guitar because I had a cheap hand-me-down and it hurt my little fingers to play it. I was 10 years old, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I gave it up for a little while, and then I went to high school and I started playing drums in the parade band, marching band at my high school. And from there, I took on all drums and percussion. And that's actually where my qualifications are on paper, is for drums and percussion. I'm qualified to teach, not on anything else I do.
Mind you, experience of life has probably given you that by now. So you're good to go.
Yeah, so I'm exposed to all kinds of different musics over the years. My dad was very deeply knowledgeable about classical music and the standards and the swing things of the 40s and 50s. Yeah. So I was getting all kinds of music coming at me, and those things sink in, even if you think, oh, old people's music, you know, something's sticking with you. It comes out later.
Very true. So you met Kim Mitchell. So how did you meet him? Because obviously he was the springboard to you getting your first record deal, wasn't it? Or the record deal.
Kim Mitchell hadn't come along at that time. I don't know how the story would have turned out. We were so determined and working so hard that maybe we would have reached, you know, a different outlet with our ability. Somebody else might have come along, but he sure gave us a shortcut from the place called the Gasworks, was the big rock bar in Toronto. Canadian bands got their start there. We were from the Gasworks to Maple Leaf Gardens within the space of a year, you know. And so Kim actually had just broken up Max Webster for a few different reasons, and his lyric writer Pai Dubois came out to see. It was our first night playing at the famous Gasworks. The other guys in the band were so excited. I didn't give a damn about it. I wasn't from Toronto, so it didn't mean anything to me. But they were, oh my God, the Gasworks, we're playing the Gasworks. Okay, yeah, whatever. So Pai Dubois, the lyric writer for Max Webster and Kim's long, long time partner in all the albums Kim did, was just out around the town, decided to come in and see this rock band that he'd heard a buzz about it. And his face was not known, because Kim would put Pai's picture on the Max Webster album covers as, here's our lyric writer.
Yeah.
And he spotted him in the crowd. We had these crazy little Coney Hatch lapel buttons.
Yeah.
So we walked the crowd and gave Pai a lapel button, and that made the connection that way. And he stuck around for the first set. He had to leave, but he said, wow, I'm really impressed. I'm going to tell Kim about you guys. So then maybe a couple of nights later, the two of them came down again, and we talked to Kim Mitchell, and he was very complimentary. And it seemed very clear. He was looking for, what do I do while I'm not Max Webster? What do I do next? So it occurred to him, maybe being a producer would be fun. So we did some demos with our first, I guess, the five best songs we had at the time, which was, they didn't all end up on the album. Hey Operator. No, it wasn't Hey Operator. We didn't have that yet. You Ain't Got Me, Devil's Deck. In fact, You Ain't Got Me was the song that got us signed. They thought that was going to be the big single.
Really? Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And Stand Up and Love Poison, which was the first song we ever wrote together. The first week I was in the band in some bar in Quebec. And Dreamland, which was a song I brought into the band, which later made it onto reissue.
Yeah, onto this reissue. Yeah, it says as an extra track. Yeah, yeah.
So that first demo, Kim brought it around to a few different labels, and ultimately it ended up with Ray Daniels at Rush and at SRO Anthem, which was Rush's label and management, and it was Kim's label at the time too. So it seemed like an obvious fit. And we got signed there, and Kim was signed to be the producer. And man, we had a great time learning so much. What an education from Kim. You know, we knew nothing about making a record, and we learned so much from him. And it was a real adventure and a lot of fun making that first album with him as the producer.
So you were signed to Phonogram. Is that when, did you go out on, I know you went out on tour with Iron Maiden, Judas Priest. Was that in the first, during the time of the first album, or was that with Out of Hand next? The
Judas Priest tour.
Yeah.
When they had Screaming for Vengeance out.
Yeah.
And then the second album was with Iron Maiden. Our Out of Hand album was out currently with that Peace of Mind tour that they were doing. So we had our rights around the world with, I guess, Phonogram, as it was called in England. Polygram Mercury was the parent company.
Yeah.
And then our rights in Canada were held by Anthem Records because they kept their own territory. But so we had release around the world through Polygram Mercury. And then I guess it didn't hurt us to have Rush's manager to be able to get on those good tours.
Absolutely, because you're on this in the UK. You're on the same label as Def Leppard.
Yes, that became a thing that we started to be very aware of at some point.
Because I wonder that, because Out of Hand, that was produced by Max Norman, wasn't it? It's a great sounding record as well.
Yeah.
But and it's like you're going out on tour with Judas Priest. You weren't quite like that kind of metal band. You were more Def Leppard than Priest. But I suppose being on the same label.
But we did have a pretty tough sounding live presentation of our shows. Yeah, you know, what I was saying, you know, earlier in our talk here about what I got from those bluesy rock bands, that feeling of being strong and solid. I wanted to have that feeling when I play rock music. You know, I'm standing solidly on my 2 feet and putting something together that's powerful, putting something across.
Yeah.
There were days when I was singing in front of Coney Hatch that I felt like I was a tank commander. It just felt like just a powerful rolling thing rolling along with me at the front of it. Yeah, here we go.
Yeah, because that was 1983. That I feel that because there was a gap then, not a very long gap in today's gaps, times of albums coming out, but Friction. Yep. I thought Friction was going to be the album that would just blow the world apart and you would just elevate to literally the first division, because it was, to me, it's your masterwork. Every track on that album is just perfect.
Yes, well, thank you very much. You know, we put our heart and soul and really risked the farm on the album. We worked for months on it with hardly any pay in our own pockets, but it was all about sacrifice now for the big payoff later. And we really thought we'd done something great there, but the market isn't always the only factor. The audience isn't the only factor. We learned many years later, like 30 years later, that people in England and Europe really loved that album.
Yeah.
But all we were allowed to see was the perception in America, where the label here, there's a great story that goes with that. So the head of PolyGram Mercury at that time, a German fella named Gunter. We had a few people, sales guys in the States, that really believed us in us. And they asked him at a convention, Gunter, why aren't we putting more resources into this great new Coney Hatch record, Friction? You know, this could really do something. And Gunter turned to the fella and he said, because, Ted, we have other priorities. And Ted said to me, it was Ted Mellencamp, actually, John Mellencamp's brother, who became
a little guy
from PolyGram Records. He said, Carl, right there, I knew you guys was sunk. So we didn't get any support in the States at all. We couldn't even find our records anywhere. And we were running around on a tour with Crocus and Accept all over the Southwest and across Canada and back again. And it was discouraging. And we weren't hearing how much people in Europe enjoyed it and loved it.
Your other two albums are really good, but they were kind of more... This was, I think the thing with Friction was, it was one track after the other, you know, This Ain't Love, She's Gone, Wrong Side of Town, Girl from Last Night's Dream. It was like a dream set list, as if it was like it's like the whole album could have just been reeled off live. Everything came together.
If you know Kieran Dargan used to run the Firefest in Nottingham there, but the last time we went, he said, would you consider playing Friction in its entirety for your show? there's a couple of songs on there that we've never ever played. Burning Love, I think, is one.
Really? Wow, that's a great track.
I know. I hear people all the time how much they love that one. But it was, you know, it was just such a fiasco with the lack of support, even at our home label. The guy that used to work at the label quit and to start his own company, and the new guy didn't care at all about us. He was busy going off to the Toronto Blue Jays spring training with Rush guys, because he was an expert at schmoozing. So we were just left out there, hung out to dry. And it was really discouraging, to the point that I felt the emotional weight. As the singer, I had this enormous pressure on myself. If I ever make a mistake, I'm blowing it for all of us. I got to be perfect. You know, I can feel us going down, but if maybe if we try extra hard, we can get out of this. If we'd only heard from somebody that Europe and England, the UK liked that album, we might have hung in there and had a different feeling about it. But as it was, the way the United States and the North American market treated us, we felt like failures. And it was so discouraging because we'd stake everything on this album has to be our breakthrough. And we were getting that kind of from a few different sources. Oh, if your third album doesn't make it, you'll get dropped. And guess what? We got dropped.
Did the band fold then, or did you look for another label, or was it, or did you feel that the spark had started to go out then?
Well, I've learned about myself over the years that I'm a very emotional creature, and I took a lot of responsibility onto myself of being the serious one. The guy that, you know, has to stay sober to drive us to the next town. What's wrong with you guys? Why aren't you trying harder? You know, what I learned is people don't thank you for being that guy. it's kind of, here comes Carl, party's over. And because I guess I was pretty serious because I felt the obstacles stacked against us were so difficult to surmount, and we had to have just everything we could deliver at the ready at all times. If that call from the coast comes, we got to be ready, full training, whatever. So I was probably, I put so much pressure on myself that when it became obvious how we were ignored and not cared about and disrespected, it really cut to my heart. In fact, I still have a hot button to this day about feeling like I'm being ignored because of those times with Coney Hatch and the way the business just turned their backs on us when we had put our whole lives on the line for this, you know? So yes, that was a difficult pill to swallow, but it's been very wonderful to learn in the last 10, 15 years how much people like that album.
It's a superb record. And I mean, I think some of us in the UK thought that because Phonogram had got Def Leppard as well, that they didn't need two bands that were too joined at the hip, maybe.
Well, that's what Gunter at the convention was getting at.
Yeah.
Def Leppard was the priority.
Yeah. But they could have easily had two.
Anyway,
you were different. You were different, but you were melodic, and you had pop sensibilities in your songs. They weren't like Priest or Iron Maiden. They were songs. So some of these could have easily been, with the right marketing, they could have been hits. You know, The Girl from Last Night's Dream, easily. There's a hit single there. definitely what was going on. This is 1985. It's not like towards the 90s when the music scene for heavy metal was changing. This is music.
You know, a missed opportunity too. My partner in the band, Andy Curran, reminded me some old paperwork he dug up that we were offered to be on a tour with Whitesnake, a European and UK tour with Whitesnake and maybe Vandenberg or somebody like that.
Yeah, that would have been a better match. That's it in a way.
In 84, in the interval between Out of Hand and no, the label turned it down. They didn't want to give us any tour support. So that was a missed opportunity also to build a market in Europe that we could continue to return to.
So after Coney Hatch, did you think about joining another band, or did you think maybe in my career in music as now this I've done really well, but this is where it stops. What shall I do next? Were you always convinced to do music? I read somewhere that it was something about someone said, don't step away from what you're good at. Someone said that to you. Was that when you were thinking of doing something else?
Yes. I was determined. It was me that decided I couldn't put it into these words at that time, but I recognize now I felt so bad about what happened with Coney Hatch, with Friction and the just being dropped and ignored, that I thought, Jesus, because any band has little conflicts and personality things. Yeah. You know, we had two singers and competing songwriting styles, and you end up in disagreements or arguments over kind of stuff. And so when it didn't work, and I'll tell you one thing that was a driving thought for me, Max Norman had me sing almost all the songs on Friction, mm-hmm. which Andy wasn't happy about. Another driving thought for me was, oh God, if we go to do another record, Andy will insist on being the singer on most of them. And I can't live with that. Yeah. At that time, I can't do that. You know, I can't take a back seat to that with the way I sing and how I present music in my preferred way. So I let them know I'm going to start out on my own. And silly man, in naive person that I was, even with all my experience at that time, I thought I'll have my solo album by Christmas. Well, it turned out to be Christmas 8 years later. I had to go through a lot. And what I recall vividly is when we went, as I said earlier, from the Gasworks to Maple Leaf Gardens, it's, you know, the big arena in Toronto within 1 year, and the big tours we were on and playing great shows all over. And yet I felt like there was this thought bubble above my head all the time. There's something about this I just don't quite get. So, because you miss a lot of information if you go from here to there that quickly. And we didn't have active management or people who knew well, coaching us and bringing us along to understand things better. So it took, I spent about a year licking my wounds, and then somebody once said to me after that time, Carl, stop being scared, get back out there again. So I started bands again and learned from the ground up all the things that I felt I hadn't learned in that quick rise.
Yeah.
And well, it took several years. I was probably so pigheaded that I missed some opportunities maybe, but I was stuck in that. I'm never going to be out feeling that stupid and allow myself to be ignored like that again. So it was a complete reactionary thing I went through, you know?
And then we're going now, we're out of the 80s, we're into the 90s, aren't we? Is this when you sort of reconnected with, must have been like a dream job, was it, when you're heading towards the Guess Who at this time, are you, or was that later on?
The Guess Who came up along after, first of all, we did some Coney Hatch reunion dates in the late 80s, a number of them, because once we were out of our record deal and our management contract,
do what you like.
We were getting offered better money. We got to keep more of it. We were always starving musicians in the major label big days. So, you know, we could do nice shows and keep most of the money for ourselves when we had no pesky managers and labels in the way. So that was a nice thing. But what I did was I invested that money into trips to Nashville and New York and Los Angeles and other places to work with pro songwriters, because that was another thing I felt I had to learn how the pro songwriters approach things and how you consistently go at it and how to work openly with another writer. In Coney Hatch days, we'd work on our parts in secret and not show it to the other guys, but we thought it was perfect because we didn't want anybody to say it wasn't good, right?
Yeah.
So I learned how to work openly with other writers and how you just get a song done. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be Stairway to Heaven. Just get one song done, then get on to the next one. And that's how you learn to write better songs as well as you go. So that I spent a few years doing that. Then I got my first a deal for my first solo album in Europe, my Carl Dixon One album. And that was that came out in 93. So I came to Germany a couple of times to promote that with my band on one trip. And then following that, it was kind of quiet, you know. Things were, it was grunge era, and I couldn't see the way in. And so I just started to feel like I've got a young family now, and I don't know how much longer I can sustain this. And I worried that I might have to find an actual job, because as much as I love music, and I realized I've given it everything I possibly can give it, and if it's not meant to work out, then I just have to accept that. And I started, you know, I was grumbling, oh God, now what? what am I going to do? I hate this. When the call from the Guess Who came. And they, because it was some guys I knew that were working with the band, and they said, look, our singer just quit. They'd had a few guys replace Burton Cummings while the band kept going. And my friend said, we think you're the perfect guy for the job. So I ended up sending them an audition thing, and they thought it was Burton Cummings playing a joke on them when they first heard it, because it sounded so close. And that's just because of my early influences. So then I ended up joining and had a few great years with them until the original guys of the Guess Who did their reunion tour.
But you must have, because when we started the conversation, this was a band that influenced you into starting out in music. And obviously you had a major label with Coney Hatch, but then your kind of childhood heroes ring you up and say, we're looking for a vocalist. And you get the job and you're in the band singing those same songs that you bought singles of. That must have felt, that must have felt, well, awesome.
Awesome is a good word. Also, vindication that I hung in there long enough through the extremely dark days, long enough for this opportunity to come along, to come to me. Because if I'd given up when it was hardest, I wouldn't have been in position to take that opportunity. And everything that has happened since I hung in through the toughest time has surpassed.
Well, that's true, because there'll be a lot of people who watch or listen to my podcast who, maybe, a lot of people have sent questions in about, oh, I'm talking to Cole Dixon, and a lot of people know about the albums, but one of the biggest things that happened in your life, a lot of people actually aren't aware of, because they see you as you are now. They wouldn't have imagined that in 2008, everything changed, potentially forever, when you had a major car accident with how many, 53 serious injuries, was it?
I had about 50 to 53 injuries, any one of which you would have gone to the hospital for.
Yeah. And that would have been it for most people. People watching, listening to this, there's lots of videos of you talking about this, but how your approach to that, I find amazing. Now, I know that what we haven't mentioned so far is that when everyone was partying their bottoms off in the 80s and drinking and partying, your focus, you've mentioned about it's because you were driving the van, but that your lifestyle choice of, like, you know, looking after your body, looking after your mind, and being really focused on what you want to do, actually was like putting money in the bank for what happened, wasn't it? And your body breaking through this.
Great way to look at it. Yes. I was the straight-laced one. My nickname with the other guys in Coney Hatch was Milk and Cookies. Here comes Milk and Cookies. and yet, when I had this terrible accident in Australia, which we can get more into, the doctors, once when I was well enough to have a conversation much later, they said, that's the only reason you survived, was because your body was in such healthy nick. I was in the pink because I'd always stayed fit, running, swimming, push-ups, sit-ups, all just keeping strong and fit, and my lung power capacity and my heart, always ideal blood pressure throughout my life. And so I was in, my body was ready for a crisis if one came along.
People talk about a crisis might come along, the one that came along to you is like something like anyone's worst nightmare. You nearly lost your legs. You're a musician. You lost an eye. You almost lost an arm. Everything that you knew about whatever you were planning to do next was instantly put on hold. So I'd like to talk about you have the stop, think, accept, renew, thank as your maxim. But medical services can only do so much. You've got to want to get better. When you didn't know what was going on, you described coming up like from underneath a depth of water to the surface. Did you come up feeling like, I'm going to do this? Or did you have any doubt? Most people would have done about that. This is it. I'm finished.
Oh, no, I never had that thought. No. I'm just back in that place for an instant here. No, I never had that thought. I guess I had learned a great deal. First of all, my character, I'm half Estonian, and we're a very stubborn lot. We had to be to put, you know, to tolerate all the European powers traipsing back and forth across the land and just enduring. So enduring is one of the hallmarks of the Estonian people. I was very confused when I first came out of my coma after 10 days, because I had no idea where I was or what had happened. And even then, it was weird. I could not understand how badly hurt I was for some time. But as the days and weeks started to pile up, and I couldn't even turn on my side without the help of two nurses to arrange my limbs and all that, because I had 8 drainage bottles attached to different wounds on me when I came around. It was pretty, not sobering, but it got your attention. Okay, this is really bad. But once I was able to think more clearly, first of all, I had a, you know, I guess this, I've never thought about this before, and this is why I love doing interviews. The sense of responsibility I described to you earlier in this talk, of it's all on me and I can't let everyone down. I have to keep it going. I have to find a way. That is certainly the feeling I had when I started to recognize how badly hurt I was. I can't surrender. So many people are counting on me. I have to get myself together.
Were you surprised by the amount of inner strength that you actually had? I mean, or did you just think, because I know mindset is a big thing or something, because as we think, so we become. So if you think negatively, your body thinks that must be really, it must be really bad out there. But you must have been sending out these positive, obviously, vibes into your own system, and your body thought, we're going to be okay.
Yes, of course. The temptation is always there. Gee, it would really feel better if I just give up and lie here, you know, and just wallow in it for a while. But that actually doesn't feel better at all. And once I was able to form helpful thoughts, which didn't take long, I realized I was in a very, very bad predicament here. And I could not afford to be weak or surrender at all, or I'll never get out of this. So that became a mantra to myself several times each day when I was just starting to be able to sit up in the bed, look around at what had happened to me. And it was no fear, no weakness, no fear, no weakness. Just tell myself that when I was in any doubt. And I was not of a right mind quite a lot of the time, because I'd gotten the other vehicle went over top of me. So I got the undercarriage of a much bigger car whacking me in the front of the head, snapping my neck back. I got a C7 fracture in my spine. The only reason I still have my teeth is I was able, apparently, because I don't remember anything, I was able to do this to protect my teeth as the car was coming over me. Just in, you know, that much, but then it almost tore this arm off. So yes, that was a very important thought for me. And I think the years of pushing through the disappointment of being an itinerant musician, and, you know, you always have, I was talking about this with my friend, Andy Curran, you know, my partner in Coney Hatch just yesterday, that everything we do as artists is based on hope. You hope to create this thing that you are envisioning, this song, this sculpture, this painting, this book, whatever. And then you hope that it will make an impact on the world. And then you hope that will pull you forward to more good things. And every time you throw that hope out there, you're just asking for someone to squash it. So I had a lot of experience of, I guess, feeling knocked down, not so literally, but knocked down in my hopes and ambitions and finding the way to keep going and get another hope going. And that's why I have learned to say a number of my wise thoughts have come about in retrospect as I've continued to heal and get some distance on what happened. I learned that our thoughts are the most powerful force in the universe, certainly the most powerful force that humans have.
Totally.
Of those, our hope and our imagination are the most compelling. And if you can marry hope and imagination to a commitment, that is unstoppable.
It's like trying to see the world as it really is rather than how you think it is, isn't it? Or see things how they really are rather than how you think they are. But you're doing this on a multifaceted level. If someone had been told, oh, you've got a spinal injury, you may not walk again. One, we may lose your arm, so you won't be able to play the guitar again. You might be blind, or you had all of these things going on at the same time, whereas most people would have become absolutely enveloped in any one of these individually. But you just obviously just put them in little boxes in your mind and said, I'll deal with that. That'll be fine. But if we could just talk briefly about stop, think, accept, renew. Yeah. Thanks. Because I think this is really, really important, because some people will see the word accept as surrender, but it isn't, is it? It's different.
No, quite different. That acronym of START in those five words that are contained in it is a summation of what I learned from this incredible experience. And to me, it wasn't a tragedy. It was my greatest education. That when you have an incident like that, a big knockdown, you're flattened in whatever way, you first thing you do is stop and don't just try to blindly plow ahead. Who knows what more additional damage you could do to yourself or your situation. Just stop cold. I know we often use hockey analogies in Canada. Sometimes I'd get flattened on the ice. And I learned to just, okay, lie still for a second. Just see, is this finger still moving? Can I wiggle my toe? You know, is my head good? Okay, now I can get up. So you stop, you think. What just happened here? What is happening? What is my situation? And really, analyze and don't
overthink.
Well, it's more a case of don't fall prey to the illusions of how you wish it was. Realize how it really is. Yes, my leg, if I move it, it's probably going to fall right off. So good decision not to move it for a while, you know. And once you... And I did have trouble with that, because I had post-concussion syndrome and, you know, wicked blows to the head. So I had some hallucinations and things and some just determination ideas that weren't accepting. And this, I learned from my own example of not accepting at first that I did some stupid things. So once you've thought, then you accept what your reality is and reject the illusions that are not helpful. Illusions just make us not able to put our energy where it belongs. It becomes misapplied or unapplied, because you can trick yourself into not using all your resources in the most helpful way. And then once you've accepted, you renew your commitment to the things that are important to you and what you now understand you have to do. And the last one is thank, because in everything in life, we do not succeed alone. We have communities around us that help us, that we rely on, families, friends, systems in place. Now, I know England's not a particularly good example for the health service at the moment, but in the ideal situation, you know, there are fire services and police and ambulances and doctors and nurses and hospitals and medical clinics and pharmacists and all these people, these systems that are in place when something goes wrong. And they all play a role in how we come out of, how successfully we come out of a situation after our own thoughts.
Because our own thoughts are bouncing. You could have all these wonderful people around you telling you you're going to be fine, although a lot of them will probably have to try and manage your expectations. But inside, you had an inner light where you just thought, if someone's telling me I won't be able to walk again, I will be able to walk again. You had an inner belief, didn't you?
That correct. You could do this. And it was a refusal to accept that I could not return to being a singer and a performer again. That was unacceptable. I would find the way. Even if it didn't happen on a convenient schedule, I would get there. And so once you have a commitment to a goal like that, you find the way over and through the obstacles. If you don't have the commitment, you'll surrender when it gets tough.
Yeah. So by having the goal, you're almost setting up you're almost like fake it till you make it. Your brain and your body will start to believe, well, this is where we're going. So we'll follow this thought.
Yes. And you'll get really resourceful at finding solutions that you never would have thought of without the commitment to finding a solution. So, because it's so easy to give up when things get tough, unless you have that mindset. So yes, the last part, thank, you have to thank sincerely in your heart and openly everyone who played a part in helping you get out of that crisis, that situation.
Did this make you reassess your life when you were at this point? Was it like a reset to what happens, your life beyond this point? Because you're talking almost as if it was like a gift in some way. It was like, what good can come from this? Probably not at first.
They're easier to understand in retrospect.
Yeah.
When you're in the midst of it, yeah. You don't necessarily see it as a gift.
not at all.
And part of the inevitable an inevitable aspect of the process of working your way back toward full function is that you have a picture of what full function looks like. And that's quite often what you did before you were down, right? Because that's the vision you know. But you also have to be open to accepting one.
It's different. Yeah.
I learned one thing at a time. Oh, okay, I can't do that anymore. I can't really do that anymore. So I learned, and I wrote a song that contains the line, look at all you still have and not what you've lost. And what we still have, no matter what, is a hell of a lot if we tap into it.
Fantastic. And now the other thing, that you're a musician and a creative person, so your imagination obviously is plugged into the universe at all times. But how important was music as a healer in this, as you started to come out the other side?
Aside from my, from my love for my family and my feeling of commitment, honestly, one thought was, I was supposed to be at a gig, joining the Guess Who for a gig in Biloxi, Mississippi, the night after my accident.
Yeah.
I was in Australia. And so I had this abiding thought, first of all, that being the singer of the Guess Who, which I'd returned to by the time of the accident, had been the crowning achievement of my career to date. A great platform, great money, great feeling, singing these songs, even though they weren't mine, it was still, I was using my skill set at a high level. And I felt like, yes, this is what I was hanging in for all these years. So the vision was to return to that, and that I can't let the band down. They were all devastated when they heard what had happened to me. And bit by bit, though, when inevitably things change when you're not there, and people find ways to move on without you. And they had also become resigned to the fact that I couldn't get back in any kind of a hurry, no matter how much I hadn't accepted yet that I was not going to be quick about this. So they decided they had to move on. And I actually rejected that. I wrote them a letter and saying, no, you're wrong. So they reconsidered it for another month or two. And then they said, no, we do have to move on. And I couldn't have returned to the job for at least another year, maybe 2 years.
Which still maybe would have been incredibly fast. But then about, I guess the seeds were also sown that the ex-members of Coney Hatch had said that if to help you, or was it get better or give you something to aim for, that it would reform and make another album once you were ready?
You know what? The album came about sort of organically as we reconnected and started to play some shows again. And the reconnection was certainly just as a, oh, poor Carl, let's get together and, you know, see if we can give him a lift. And Andy put together a fundraising show for me and my family when I was still unable to really walk and crutches to get anywhere. That was quite a gesture. And then the guys turned up at a couple of occasions, and then we were offered a show 2.5 years after the accident, which was my first return back to that kind of a show on stage. And boy, it took everything I had because I was still regaining my strength. But that was where the turnaround happened. And then Kieran Dargan at Firefest had been in contact with me, and he said, well, look, do you think you'd be ready if we put Coney Hatch on the 2011 Firefest? And I said, damn right we will. Damn right I will. So that's how we finally made our European UK splash and everything to do with Coney Hatch.
And then in 2013, this arrives, doesn't it? The fourth album. And it's a fantastic album. It got lots of accolades, didn't it, at the time? And it's a much harder, rockier album than anything you'd done before. Had that got anything to do with what you'd been through and how your zest for life, which must have been like turned up to 12 at this point after what you'd been through?
There's something there, yes. The determination to express my return to life, the strength, the greater strength than ever that I felt inside myself from the effort I'd put forth. Rather than being diminished by that accident, I feel like I'm at my most powerful state in my life. And that was what was coming through in the songwriting and the performances on that four album.
Oh, it's a brilliant album. It's really hard. It's much more kind of heavy metal than the other albums, but it's got some great songs, great vocal performances. Was you, because also at this point, it could be later in this time in your life, I'm not quite sure, but you decided to become a speaker, go out and talk to people about what you've been through and do motivational talks.
Yes. It started around 2010 that I began.
Yeah, same time. But
that really was because it was so uncertain at that time whether I'd ever be able to return to what I used to do. And so somebody said to me, well, you could become a speaker, even if you can't become a performer and singer and musician at the level you used to. And people would probably be really interested to hear your story. So I started developing that path, and it's been so rewarding. And I'm always amazed at the impact that it has on an audience when I tell the story and the things I've learned. It makes me feel quite a bit like this is why I was spared from death that night, so that I could share what I've learned.
I did wonder that. It's almost like some guardian angels looking after you or something, or some of a higher power, because you've got two paths of like, this is why I'm on the planet, you know?
Yeah. Yes, you're right. Two hats, to share what I can do musically and to share what I've learned. And I come, you know, when I do the speaking, I play a few songs acoustically, but use the line, it must have been a whole squadron of angels looking over me that night for me to even survive the impact, let alone return to a thriving life.
Yeah, because I think what you do there musically, I've always, one of the kind of maxims at Now Spinning Magazine is that music is the healer and the doctor. You know, it takes us out of ourselves. It changes the atmosphere of the room, whether it's played, whatever it is we're doing. But obviously what you're doing as well, that side of your career, personality, is also must be helping thousands of people around the world.
It's very rewarding and very humbling is an overused word these days, but it makes me feel like I have a mission without being too messianic about it, I know that it's now my responsibility to share what I've learned and to offer people a hopeful message of, look, I got through this terrible thing. Here's some ideas how you can get through your terrible thing.
Watching the little video clips on your website, it's kind of like it puts everything in perspective. It's like, you know, there are certain musicians. I'm Maiden, you know, the lead vocalist have had cancer and he flies a plane and he's an Olympic fencer and everything. There's certain people and you're one of them. It just shows that what you can do. I saw the injuries of what your arm was like. As a musician, you know, that you thought, now I will be able to do this. I will be able to pick up a guitar and I will play it. And as you've said, that when you first started doing those talking gigs, you were still then picking up an acoustic guitar, even though you weren't quite sure, this was before this album, where it was going. But you thought, no, I can do this. I think it's, you know, that kind of drive and positive outlook is an inspiration to all of us. It really is.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, it's as simple as if you know where you want to go and you're determined to get there, you will find a way. But first, you have to be determined to get there.
And are you still, obviously, your investment in your own health before this happened got you through it. And is that something you still do now? You still look after yourself and keep fit best on what you can, yeah?
Yeah, I manage my weight. I eat healthy food. I was just swimming in the lake again this morning. I can't run anymore. I can't even hurry across the street if a car is coming at me. But I still do chin-ups and push-ups and all the stretching and some yoga and all kinds of things to keep my strength and my fitness up. And I perform a lot. So that keeps my vocal capacity, my lung capacity, I should say, very powerful still. And my blood pressure is still ideal.
And with being on stage with kind of like the different lighting and everything, obviously, because you lost one of your eyes, did that change your perception of where things are? Or have you just, again, your brain just adapts and compensates to...
Does adapt, but there are still times where I bang my head unhelpfully if I get in an unfamiliar situation, and they drilled a hole in my head here to let the pressure, because it swelled up like a basketball. So every once in a while, I get a bang right there because I'm blind on this side, so I can't see when something is right there, and I go, oh, So that I've actually given myself a mild concussion a few more times just through I can't see.
You can't see, no.
That's something I've had to just learn to be patient with myself. That's how it is now. I'll go lie down and don't whine.
No, as you said, stop, think, accept, renew, and thank. That's a wonderful approach to life, or any kind of, as you, the troughs, or the, you know, the, as we, as you say, life is all about ups and downs. When we go peaks, down into the,
that's what I call it, peaks and valleys.
Peaks and valleys. When we're in the valley, it's a great set of words for when we're in the valley. So, thank you very much, Carl. You've got a few gigs coming up as well, haven't you? Because Coney Hatch are alive and kicking, and got, as you say, the live album coming out with a couple of new tracks bolted on as well. So when's that due?
And we'll be in Germany next week at Hamburg.
Yeah.
For a festival called Indoor Summer Fest. I think it's kind of like Fire Fest in Nottingham was, and with the Heat Festival where we recorded our live album. So we're looking forward to that. I love going to Europe and to Germany and the UK. We've got a couple of more dates in September, and then we're all doing some other things, but then picking up again in January for some shows and beyond January.
Fantastic. So the band, so do you think you'll do at some point a new studio album at some point in the future?
That discussion has just arisen because we're now back with our old album, our old label, Anthem Records.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's full circle.
People, but a company bought the catalog of all the old Rush, Coney Hatch, Max Webster, Gowan things that were part of their vault. And so they asked, can we revive the Anthem name? when to go with this. So yeah. And there's some lovely people running it now that they said, we want the Anthem relationship with Coney Hatch to be better than it ever was. So we're talking about the next album. Yes.
Oh, brilliant. Fantastic. So where's the best place for fans to find you? Is it the Coney Hatch website or on your own website as well?
Yes, I have carldixon.com. There's a coneyhatch.com, or is it CA?
Coneyhatch.com.
And Carl Dixon Speaks is my speaker page. We also have a Coney Hatch Facebook page, which I guess you have to, even though I don't know. I'm still not convinced what benefit it has except to interact with the fans. And maybe that's enough to get out of it, where people can reach when they can't any other way.
Yeah, that's very, very true. Because it is. I mean, I think the way that you interact with your fans and the websites, and I think anyone watching this and listening, I'll put the links to Coney Hatch and Carl's websites below, and make sure you visit Carl's speaking website as well. There's some really, really inspirational videos on there. There really is.
This has been very enjoyable, Phil. I'm glad to do this interview with you. And for all the UK fans, we're dreadfully sorry that our tour back in January was cancelled. It was circumstances beyond our control, but somebody else's money was the problem that never arrived. So
that rock and roll stories. Yeah.
Rock and roll. Yeah. The great rock and roll swindle or something like that. Yeah. So we sure do want to get there. We just have to figure out a way that it'll be good for everyone.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Carl. Good luck with the album. I can't wait to get hold of a copy myself, and take care of yourself. It's been really inspirational talking to you. So take care. So hopefully we'll talk again soon in the future.
I do hope so. Yes. I would enjoy picking up this discussion. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, a huge thank you to my guest, Carl Dixon, from Coney Hatch. That's got to be one of the most inspiring interviews I've ever done. You know, what Carl's been through and his approach to it is an inspiration for us all. And it really is an indicator of how music is the healer and the doctor. And so is our mindset and how we approach our thoughts as we go through life. So thank you, Carl. That was absolutely amazing. I should put links to the Coney Hatch website and Carl Dixon's own speaking website as well any second now at the end of this section, but it will also be in the description area of the website and underneath the description on the YouTube channel and on the podcast channels as well. But thank you again to Carl Dixon for being my guest. It's absolutely superb. And if there's an album by Coney Hatch everyone should have, it's Friction. It's an absolutely melodic rock AOR classic. As I said in the interview, it's something that could be played end to end. It's like the perfect set list, an absolute every home should have one type of album. So thank you for being here. Thank you for watching or listening. Check out the Now Spinning website at nowspinning.co.uk. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. Visit us on Facebook. Join the private Facebook group. See us on Twitter, Instagram, wherever else you could find us, of course. Tell everyone you've met about us. Ring that little bell on the YouTube channel. Become a patron or a YouTube member. And as I said before, remember, music is a healer and the doctor. Keep spinning those discs. And I shall see you on the next episode.